As we have mentioned before in our study of the book of Ecclesiastes, the book of Ecclesiastes is a coming-of-age tale. It is a story that a father is telling his son in order to dissuade him from seeking life through the vain philosophies of the world, the vain philosophies of the nations, and to persuade his son in order to draw him in through his argument. He tells him a story about the man who saw it all, the man who had it all, the man who tried it all. And he calls him the preacher. And through the preacher, the father is saying, been there, done that, waste of time. So that the son will seek life where it can be found by choosing to fear God and keep his commandments. As the book opened, we saw that the preacher began his experiment to discover what good can be found down here and out there. And which he does by seeking meaning and happiness through pleasure, through possessions, through wisdom and work. And he concluded that it doesn't satisfy, it doesn't last, it doesn't matter. There is no life out there. And last time, we saw the preacher consider man's place in the world, his place in this big scheme. And he concluded that man is not free, man is not judge, man is not God. He is just a creature. So it would behoove him to acknowledge his Creator. We will turn to the next part of his argument today in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. So if you'll meet me there in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, I'm going to start in verse 1. Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of the oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. I think of the words of Nietzsche, who said, "This world is the will to power and nothing besides. And you yourselves also are this will to power and nothing besides." The preacher looks around and he says, "It seems to me that there are two classes of people in the world. There are the oppressors, and there are the oppressed," which is a very interesting thing for us to read in light of much of our modern discourse. There's been a lot of discussion recently regarding oppressed classes. There was a time when we were finding new ones almost daily. You know, we keep finding new oppressed classes because we keep inventing new oppressed classes. So we have things like LGBTQQIP2SAA. And nobody knows how many genders. The last time I checked, there was somewhere upwards of 50, but I guarantee nobody knows them all. And at some point, it just seems that in our culture, being oppressed became trendy. It became trendy because it became powerful. You could get a job by being oppressed. You could cause someone to lose their job because you're oppressed. So everybody seemed to want to get in on a piece of the action, and intersectionality is something that provided us with the means so that everybody can get in. Everybody can get in on a piece of the action. Everybody except, well, we got to have an oppressor group. So if you are a Christian, or conservative, or straight, or white, or a male, you're out. Because we have to have at least one group that are the oppressors. But everybody else can get in, and you can gain, you can benefit from this power if you just except that you are the oppressed. So what's the solution? Well, the solution that is offered by the wisdom of the world is to take power from the group that has it and to give it to the other group, which many institutions have fallen over themselves to do because of the pressure, because of the power that is being exerted upon them by the self-described oppressed. But if we take power from one group and we just give it to another group, then won't that group in turn become the oppressors, since by definition the oppressor is the one with the power? And if everything in this world is just a power play, if it's just about might makes right, if it's just about the will to power, then isn't that complaint just an attempt to manipulate my emotions in an effort to gain power over me? I mean, if all exists is a will to power, why should I care? It is, of course, not a new discussion, though its infiltration into many churches in America is new. It's not a new philosophy. It wasn't new when Marx and Lenin taught it either. But what is important for us to understand when we approach a text such as this is it wasn't a philosophy that existed in the preacher's day. So you need the seedbed of Christian morality for something like that to grow in. Okay? You have to borrow from God's character, which values the meek, it values the poor, it values the orphan, it values the widow, it values the have-nots. You have to start with that in order to manipulate it. And that's why that philosophy has been so successful in the Christian West. Because while, by and large, we have moved away from the story, we have moved away from God, but we have still tried to maintain the morality. You know, even in many churches, we turn away from the story. We turn to topical teaching. Okay, our preaching that's focused on how to be a better spouse, a better parent, a better Christian. We've become so focused on how we should live, how we should behave, and we've completely neglected the why in the process. This is how you ought to act, ought to think. But why? Why is it that God chooses to steward His rule to the humble? Why is it that the meek will inherit the land? The world that the preacher is observing is pre-Christianized. This is a world where might makes right. It takes everything you can from everyone you can, and it leaves nothing for anybody else. In the preacher's world, it's not trendy to be oppressed. There is no power in being oppressed. There is blatant oppression going on. I don't have to explain to you how it is that one person is being oppressed. It's obvious. And no one's there to help the oppressed. No one is there to show mercy. Why not? Because it doesn't benefit them. There is no benefit in being oppressed in this world. So the preacher looks at life out there and he says, well, if it's the law of the jungle, if it's just dog eat dog, the strong are out here preying on the weak and no one cares. Who wants to live in a world like that? They'd be better off not to live at all. That's the world he is observing. He goes on. Verse 4. I've seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity. It's striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. The preacher turns his attention to the question, what is it that is driving man? It's driving him over here to oppress. It's driving him here in his labor. It's motivating his labor. Why? Why is he doing it? What is it that convinces him to go to work an hour early and to stay at work an hour late? Why does he do this to himself? Answer? It's his neighbor. It's Bob across the street who just got a new John Deere tractor. So he needs a new John Deere tractor. But he doesn't have enough for a new John Deere tractor. So what has he got? Well, he's got to put in more hours. But by the time he gets the John Deere tractor, well, now Bob's got something else. So now he needs more. So he's got to work more. And on it goes. He's keeping up with the Kardashians. You know, we live in one of the least impoverished societies that has ever existed on planet Earth. In all of history, right now, our standard is of life is of living has risen astronomically, so that even the poorest among us have cell phones and access to internet. You cannot have a house, not have a car, and not know where your next meal is, but you have a cell phone. That's the world that we live in. The toys that we have, the toys that our children have at home, video games and all the rest, are things that kings would have traded their kingdoms for. Air conditioning. Are you kidding me? Refrigeration. Our bathrooms are inside our houses, and it's not wrecking the place. Can you believe it? These are modern marvels that we are all benefiting from. But in spite of all of this, in spite of the elevating of our socioeconomic statuses, you know what still hasn't changed? The crime rate. The crime rate stays the same. See, the intelligentsia hasn't gotten this message yet. We say it's the environment. If only we can change man's environment, then man will be good. The problem is, you see, he doesn't have, so he takes. That's his problem. If he had, man would be a good boy. Because he starts off neutral, or maybe even slanted good. He wants to be a good boy, but he's put in a bad situation. If we can just change the environment, things will change. Viktor Frankl, I think of that Jewish psychologist who he went through the horrors of the Holocaust, and he observed in these concentration camps how some people made it through and some people died rather quickly. And his observations, he published in a book his observations. Ultimately, his conclusion was that if a man can endure anyhow, so long as he has a why. You know, the people that didn't last didn't have a why in their life. But the ones that had a why, the ones that understood and had a meaning and a purpose, they were the ones that endured. They were the ones that made it the distance. But he makes this statement in that book, in The Unheard Cry for Meaning. He says, "For too long we have been dreaming a dream from which we are now waking up. The dream that if we just improve the socioeconomic situation of people, everything will be okay. People will become happy. The truth is that as the struggle for survival has subsided, the question has emerged. Survival for what? Ever more people today have the means to live, but no meaning to live for." That's it. Man's satisfaction, his happiness, his contentment has nothing to do with his access to food or his access to amenities. Because man's problem has nothing to do with poverty. See, man has a character problem. Man's satisfaction is relative to his status compared to other people around him because he has a character problem. And that puts him in a constant fight to stay on top. It is a fleeting satisfaction, a fleeting happiness. As soon as he thinks he's got his arms around it, the moment he stops to enjoy it, he's been passed. He's second place. And there's no enjoyment for man in second place. Well, what about those who can't keep up? What about those who fall behind? Well, the preacher says he's the fool. He folds his hands. He consumes his own flesh. Well, we're also finding that more and more in our society are waking up to the fact that the chips are stacked against them. They are playing a zero-sum game, and the game is rigged. And they say, look, if I can't win, I'm just not going to play. I'll take my toys and go home. They opt out altogether. Article after article, statistic after statistic, have shown that many men, most of whom are straight white men, because that's the majority of our country, are choosing to drop completely out of the system. College enrollment is dropping. Worker unemployment is rising. They're giving up on life in the real world to come home and self-medicate in an online fantasy funded by their parents. They've given up on the American dream. That's a thing of the past. But that fantasy won't last forever, because mommy and daddy won't last forever. And Solomon is looking at this and he says, they don't work to their own detriment. They don't realize that their time is coming. They fold their hands, but they're consuming their own flesh. At the end of the day, his conclusion, both mindsets are equally treacherous. Give up on the rat race, but don't give up on work altogether. It's better to settle for third place with a good night's sleep. Don't work with the motivation to be better than your brother. Be satisfied with enough. Verse 7. I have looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes weren't satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity. It's a grievous task. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. And if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they can keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. On December 19th, 1843, Charles Dickens published his book, A Christmas Carol, and in the preface of the book he wrote, I have endeavored in this ghostly little book to raise the ghost of an idea, which shall not put my readers out of humor with themselves, with each other, with the season, or with me. May it haunt their houses pleasantly, and no one wish to lay it. And that ghost of an idea, which he carries through the vehicle of the main character of the story, Ebenezer Scrooge. I think of the description of Scrooge in the book. We all know Scrooge. And early on it says, oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire. Secret and self-contained, and solitary as an oyster. Now, I think of this message he's writing. That's not far from the character in the text. It sounds like the preacher, he's watching the Christmas Carol, says, what good does Ebenezer Scrooge have for all of his work? What's the point of it all? Why is he depriving himself? You know, isn't he just going to end up like his old partner, Jacob Marley? And Marley was dead as a doornail. Now, I've known many misers, but I've never known a happy miser. Not one. In fact, the one trait that they all seem to share is that they're not happy. They're not satisfied. None of them are content. Not one. See, their passion for their pocketbook puts them at odds with everybody close to them. Because, you know, if you're pinching your pennies, you got to go without. There has to be a little suffering involved. But the trade-off for the miser while he's suffering is at least he gets to look and check the numbers in his bank account. But nobody around you gets that pleasure. They just get to suffer with you. It's miserable. Man was not made for envy. Man was not made for greed. Man was made for, according to the preacher, community. He was made for community. See, two is better than one. They get a good return for their labor. At the creation, I think of the creation week. By the end of the week, everything God created was very good. It was good when it was finished. But not everything was very good during the process, was it? it was not good for man to be alone. So the Lord made him a helper. We were made for community. And so naturally, community has its advantages. The preacher says people are better together because verse 9, they have a good return for their labor. I used to work at a point of sale company many years ago, and my coworkers would talk about dinks. You ever heard that term before? A dink? You know what a dink is? Dual income, no kids. Dinks have a good return for their labor. The preacher looks at man's activities under the sun and he says, you know, things work out for man when man is working together. When he's not at odds, when he's not motivated trying to get what's good for him at the cost of his brother. When he's working together with his brother, things work out for man. But then he throws a wedding verse in here for us, verse 12. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. I think that's the only place I've ever heard that verse is in a wedding. It might have been in our wedding. I can't remember. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. And typically the way that we preach that or teach it is that, well, you know, just as man and woman need one another, you really need God in your relationship to make this thing work. See, a cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. Which is true, but is that really what the preacher is saying? He's like, all right, I'm tell you this about your problem with one another, and by the way, here's a little marriage verse in there. No. What's the preacher saying? Well, it's actually pretty simple. It's a matter of addition, you see. If two are better than one, then three are better than two. That's what the preacher is saying. It works. As long as we're working together, more people is more better. But unfortunately, people can be fickle, as we will find. Verse 13. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he's come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. I've seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him. For this too is vanity, striving after the wind. This section is a little tricky. It's a little difficult to translate, to track exactly what's going on. And depending on what translation you have, it might read wildly different than my New American Standard just read. But as best as I can tell, looking at the text, the story is this. There is a king who is a fool because he won't take advice or warning. It's verse 13. He's replaced by a youth who is wiser, though he was once poor and even in prison. The youth has wisdom, so the people prefer the youth. But the young king's wisdom wasn't enough, because we find in verse 15 and 16, he's replaced by another youth who's popular. See, this one was wise. This one's popular. But the popularity, according to verse 16, the way it ends, is only temporary. It won't last either. See, it's all transitory. Power, prestige, influence. It comes and it goes. And it goes just as quickly as it comes. It's beyond me why anybody would want a position of power in our world today, especially the highest position of power. When the limelight finds somebody, you can count on it, their days are numbered. I think of Andrew Cuomo. He was hot stuff for a while, but good grief. He was the media's darling. And then the next thing you know, I mean, it looks like he's going to be set up for a presidential run. But all that publicity led to his downfall. Now, you want to climb the ladder, go ahead. But the more visible you are, the more vulnerable you are. The higher the position, the harder the fall. And that falls on both sides of the aisle, by the way. Public opinion is prone to change. When was the last time you can remember in your lifetime that our country was happy with our leadership? That there was bipartisan pride in the leadership of the country? that across party lines, you know, we thought, I may not agree with their policies, but they're doing a good job. When was the last time that happened? So I don't even know who has it worse, really, the president or the press secretary. You know, at least the president has to answer for his own decisions. The press secretary has to get up there and take shots all day for somebody else's decisions. It's a bad spot. It's all transitory. People are fickle. The same people, you know, I think of Jesus. You cannot please the mob. Even Jesus could not please the mob. The same people that were crying out, Hosanna in the highest on Palm Sunday, were the people who were saying, we have no king but Caesar on Good Friday. People are fickle. Power is fleeting. Prestige, all of it transitory. Chapter 5, verse 1. So he says, guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. For they don't know that they're even doing evil. Or they don't even know they're doing evil. Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. For God is in heaven and you're on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For the dream comes through much effort and the voice of a fool through many words. When you make a vow to God, don't be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It's better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Don't let your speech cause you to sin, and don't say in the presence of the messenger, it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams and in many words, there is emptiness. Rather, fear God. It was the first century Greek philosopher Plutarch who observed that if we traverse the world, it is possible to find cities without walls, without letters, without kings, without wealth, without coin, without schools and theaters. But a city without a temple, or that practiceth not worship, prayer, and the like, no one ever saw. The preacher takes a moment to consider the religiosity of the sons of men, which leads him to issue a warning lest a syncretism eat its way into his son, that he starts doing the things that they're doing. Do not approach God in the manner that they do. Don't do it like they do it. How do they do it? Verse 1, they don't come to listen. Instead, they offer what he calls the sacrifice of fools. What is the sacrifice of fools? Well, in this passage, it's their words. It's their words. It's the things that they say. They do not come to hear God. They come to tell God. Verse 2, they are hasty. They are in a hurry to bring up a matter before God, which means that they are consumers. And they're treating the temple like a fast food factory. Okay, they're running in and they're trying to make a transaction. It's transactional. This is what I need. They come because they want something. And because they want something, the way that they try to get it, verse 4, is that they make vows. Lord, if you only get me out this time, then I'll A, B, C, D. Then I'll start going to church regularly. Then I'll give up that thing I should have given up already. If you only do this time, Lord. See, they're making vows to try to get God to do what they want. It's manipulation. It's a bribery game. That's how magic works in the ancient Near East, by the way. When you think of the various things they do, the incantations that they recite, the spell books that they have, the little trinkets that they use, it's because the gods of the East are not transcendent. That is, the gods of the East are made up of the stuff of this world. They are in the world, and because they are, they can be manipulated like everything else in the world. If you say the right thing, if you do the right thing, then they have to come through. If I do a rain dance, he has to bring me rain. God's not like that. In fact, Jesus, interestingly, is going to give a very similar warning to what the preacher is saying here about how the nations are operating. You might recall in the Sermon on the Mount, he's coming and presenting himself as the righteousness of God, saying, you guys need to seek me, ask me, find me, knock, I'll open it, I'll give it to you. The righteousness of God. But he's looking over at their teachers, the Pharisees. And he's saying, and by the way, don't do anything the way that they do it. Your teachers aren't teaching you the law. They're not following the law. They're not getting into the kingdom. You need a righteousness greater than theirs. You need what I got. Don't do anything like, don't pray like they pray through many words, the offering of a fool. Don't give money the way that they give money. Don't do anything the way that they're doing it. The preacher says, the way that the nations are approaching God is empty because God cannot be bribed. You might get something from God with that approach, but it ain't going to be what you think. Verse 6, it says you might anger him. It might lead to the destruction of your labor. You make a vow and then you don't keep it. Lord, this time, if you bail me out this time, then he bails you out, but you never come through. It says you might reap a curse instead. Instead, the preacher offers then these simple instructions. Verse 1, be on guard. Watch your steps. We went to Israel, y'all recall, not too long ago, and on the steps leading up to the Temple Mount, it's a bizarre thing. You know, we have uncovered the steps, but the width of them differs greatly from step to step. I mean, like one is like, I don't know, what is it, like 2 feet wide, 3 feet wide? I can't even remember. You have a normal step and then this really wide step followed by a normal step and then another really wide step. You say, this is just bizarre. Why would anyone build steps like this? This is a good way to trip and fall and break your neck on the way up to the temple. Why would anyone do this? So that no one could run on them. You can't run on those steps. By design, you cannot run. It's to slow you down, so that you are careful when you are approaching the temple. Guard your steps. Don't be hasty. Don't be impulsive, it says, to bring up a matter before God. Verse 2. Verse 7, rather, fear God. Okay, I'm not coming to him like he's a used car salesman that I can work over with a deal. This is God in heaven. I need to approach him with reverence, with caution, because he is dangerous, with fear. Verse 8. If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, don't be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. After all, the king who cultivates the fields is an advantage to the land. Solomon says, there is no exception to the rule. Government is corrupt. It's kind of the reverse of trickle-down economics. If you put the squeeze on an official, that official is not going to eat the cost. He's going to pass the cost down to the people that he's over, and on and on. And ultimately, the squeeze is going to get passed down to the people. It's the same thing going on in our country today. We don't have the same setup that they have, but large corporations play a major role in our society. If we're trying to raise money, you can put the squeeze on corporations. Are they going to eat it? No, they're going to pass it down, and it's going to come to you, the consumer. It's going to be passed down to the people. This is what Samuel, if you remember when Samuel was talking to the people and he had those rotten sons, they were good for nothing. The people said, well, we don't want your sons to rule us. They're unjust. They're wicked. They take bribes. What we need is a king like the nations. And Samuel says, no, you need to be careful what you ask for. You ask for a king, what's he going to do? Well, he's going to take your sons, your daughters, your stuff. He's going to tax the fool out of you. You don't want a king. God is your king. And they say, no, we want a king. That's what they got. They got Saul and Solomon and on down the list, by the way. You know, Solomon, he didn't build that temple out of thin air. There's a reason why the kingdom split economically. We think of the reason behind it is because Solomon went after other gods. That's true. So in the days of his son, the kingdom was split. That's the real reason behind the story. But in the like if you get closer, ratchet in, look at the economics of the deal. In the days of his son, the people came in and said, your dad's wearing us out with all his building. Lighten the load, guy. And his son said, no. In fact, I will increase the load. So the kingdom split. Oppression and government for the sake of greed is the norm. That is the standard. This is not exception. It's the rule. Verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man doesn't allow him to sleep. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment and he'd fathered a son, there's nothing to support him. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so he returned as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. This is also a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. In a 2014 Wall Street Journal article, Charles Murray writes, years ago, I was watching a television profile of David Geffen, the billionaire music and film producer. At some point, he said, show me someone who thinks that money can buy happiness, and I'll show you someone who's never had a lot of money. The remark was accompanied by an ineffably sad smile on Mr. Geffen's face, which said that he had been there, done that, knew what he was talking about. The whole vignette struck me in a way that money can't buy happiness, never had, and my visceral reaction was reinforced by one especially memorable shot during the profile taken down the length of Mr. Geffen's private jet along the rows of empty leather seats and sofas where he sat all alone in the rear. Lack of money is not the problem. And since lack of money isn't the problem, more of it is not the solution. Quite the contrary, says the preacher. More money, more problems in this world. The only thing the money is good for is to sit there and look at it. But as your wealth increases, so your problems in this world increase. Ultimately, it leads him to the question, what good is it for? I don't have anything that wasn't given to me, like Paul says, but the preacher's saying, look, and you don't have anything that you can take with you when you go. All of it is temporary. The best you're doing is renting it for a time. It goes back to the factory when you die. So why are you doing all this? Verse 18. Here's what I've seen to be good and fitting: to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun, during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he's also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For, verse 20, he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. We saw this already in chapter 3 when the preacher was looking through the various things that the sons of men were up to. He's saying, I want to see what God has given to the sons of men. What has he given them that keeps them occupied during their short time on this earth? You know, as they're running around without God and without hope in the world, what are they up to? And what good is there for them? What good is there? Well, it's the same conclusion he had in the previous chapter. Eat, sleep, be satisfied. The folks that God gives money to, he gives it to them to occupy them. That is also why whenever you come into Matthew and come into the Gospels, we have this question about the things in a person's life. Is there anything that is it more difficult for some people to enter heaven? Answer: yes, it is more difficult for some people to receive the message. In that instance, it's the rich. Because, you see, they have things to keep them occupied, to keep them satisfied in life. They're riches. They don't have as much ability to recognize their need of God because they think they provide it for themselves. It keeps them occupied. Boy, is it hard for a rich man to enter heaven, he says. The disciples say, look, we left everything, Lord. What is there for me? Oh, there's, I know. You'll inherit the kingdom. But it's hard for a rich man. So I look here. I look at what has been given to the sons of man to keep them busy. I look at this problem of greed and envy, of strife against one's neighbor, and this pursuit of satisfaction, this pursuit of happiness. And I ask the question, what about us? Us who are sitting here and listening to this story, what are we to learn from the preacher? What is the punchline? What is the takeaway? I think that the punchline that the preacher is leaving us with, and the father, in essence, leaving his son, is if you are looking to the world to satisfy, you need to know going in that the world is not enough. The world is not enough. You know, if you allow your envy, your greed, your desire to acquire to be the motive behind your relationships and your religion, if you are a user, it's only going to lead to suffering. Now, there's something about the sin within man that seems to be stirred up with the concept of ownership. Ownership is a good thing, but boy, when we get a little bit of it in us, it causes strife between us and our brother. It does it in a way that stewardship does not. I think of a story, I don't know if the story is apocryphal or not, but there's a story of John Wesley when his house burned down. Someone came up to him and said, Mr. Wesley, your house is burned down. He says, I don't have a house. I manage a house for the Lord. His house just burned down. There is wisdom in that. That is the proper attitude. We think about it when we come to give to the Lord. All that we have received. We can't take any of it with us. We all have 100% of what we have. We don't have the same 100%, but we all have 100% of what we have. How do we manage it? Is the goal in life to accumulate more of it? Is God going to check our accounts at the end of the day and say, you know, did you come out of life with more wealth than I put you in that world with? Obviously not. But He is concerned with how we manage it. And again, at the end of the day, we got the same amount, 100%. So am I using it then to build walls between me and my neighbor? Or am I using it to build up my brother? Am I coming to the Lord as a vending machine, seeking to give me more wealth? Am I seeking my ends in that relationship, or am I seeking Him for who He is? Do I come in the fear of the Lord and the reverence and the desire to serve Him well by managing what I steward well and by loving my neighbor well? That's the punchline.